What's up, guys? I'm really excited for today's episode because I got to sit down with one of the leading experts in artificial intelligence, Yoshua Bengio. He's one of the people that signed the letter asking for a moratorium to be placed on AI development. And in this episode, we get all into what he's worried about, what he's excited about, where he thinks the future of AI is going. And let me tell you, it is not going where any of us think. And the ability to hear it directly from somebody so well-versed in this area was incredibly enlightening and sobering. AI is a field that is moving so quickly, and if you're not paying attention right now, you will get left behind or possibly even expose yourself to dangers unnecessarily. This is the kind of episode that I always am excited to do because it is so relevant to what's going on right now and got me in front of one of the most important thinkers on the topic. So guys, I hope that you enjoy listening to this episode on AI, the future, and the dangers as much as I enjoyed recording it. And if you did, please pass it on, tell other people about it, subscribe to the show, like it, rate, review, do all the things. All right, guys, I'm Tom Bilyeu, and welcome to Impact Theory. I want to start with a quote from Ilya Sutskever. He said, for people that don't know, he's a co-founder of OpenAI. He said, it may be that today's large neural networks are slightly conscious. So I want to pose that question to you. Are computers becoming conscious right now?
I think it's a question that doesn't make much sense because we don't even have a clear scientific understanding of what conscious means. So based on that, I would say no. There are lots of properties of our consciousness that are missing. What it means to be conscious, in other words, what sort of computations are going on in our brain when we become conscious of something? How that is related to notions, for example, of self or relations to others, how thoughts emerge and how they're related to each other, all kinds of clues we have about consciousness, including how it's implemented in neural circuits that are completely missing in large language models.
All right. As we think about consciousness from an evolutionary standpoint, we think about its utility. And for people that haven't heard consciousness defined before, I think the easiest way to explain it is it feels like something to be a human. And so the question is, does it feel like something to be a machine? And the most important question, I think, as we think about the dangers of AI and what's coming is, does it matter? Is it additional utility for it to feel like something to be a human or to be a machine? Do you agree that that's going to matter in terms of goal orientation, in terms of quote unquote wanting to do something as we think about our AI? You know, is it going to take over? Are we going to be dealing with killer robots? Or am I totally off base with that?
My group put out a paper just in the last couple of months, and we have proposed a theory that is anchored in how brains compute. So the theory has to do with the dynamical nature of the brain. In other words, you know, you have a 80 billion neurons and their activity is changing over time. The trajectory that your brain goes through as all these neurons change their activity tends to converge towards some configuration when you're becoming conscious. That convergence has mathematical implications that would suggest that what we store in our short-term memory are these thoughts that are discrete but compositional. In other words, like think like a short sentence. And it's also something ineffable, which means it's very hard to translate in words. And there are good reasons for that. It's just that it would take a huge number of words to be able to translate the trajectory, that state of your brain, which is a very, very high dimensional object, into words. It's just impossible, essentially. So even though we may communicate with language, we may have a different interpretation of what this means, and especially, and in particular, a different subjective experience because of our life has been different, right? So we've learned different ways of interpreting the world.
Okay, if consciousness is a byproduct of the feeling I get when my particular brain is honing in on a thought, that there is a neural pattern that becomes recognizable, the the thing I think that becomes important, and the reason that I think this is important as we think about artificial intelligence potentially becoming killer robots, is my big thing with AI has always been AI has to want something. It has to want an outcome.
Not necessarily.
Interesting. Let me finish that sentence and then we'll pick that apart. But if I'm right, and AI has to want something, and that's certainly how humans behave, then I understand the utility of this ineffable feeling that you're talking about that we call consciousness. Because for humans to make a decision and know what direction to go in, we must have emotion. If you selectively damage the region of the brain that controls emotion, people cannot make decisions. They can tell you all the rational reasons why they should eat fish instead of beef or beef instead of fish, but they can't then actually decide and do it. So we need that feeling that where this thing is more desirable than that thing. And so my thinking has always been, as it relates to AI, that if AI doesn't want something, it will never be from an emotional standpoint. If it doesn't feel like anything to be a robot, they will never have the final decision-making capability to care enough to take over the world. And so that's where it's like, if it becomes conscious and it suddenly feels like something to be a robot, then they're going to be motivated in a direction. That direction could be bad, it could be good, whatever. But they're going to be motivated in a direction now if they are like humans. But if they never become conscious or it never feels like anything, I would think they would be much like they are now, where it's like, well, it could be this, it could be that, if you've ever talked to ChatGPT, which of course you have, but that feels like it would sort of be a perpetual state of affairs. What might I be getting wrong?
My belief is that you're talking about two things that are actually quite separate, as if they're one. So wanting something, having goals, and getting some kind of internal or external reward for achieving those goals is something that we already do in machine learning. You know, reinforcement learning is all based on this, and you don't need subjective experience for that. So these are like really distinct capabilities. Subjective experience is related to thoughts that we discussed earlier. We could have machines that have something like thoughts, and potentially if we implement it similarly to how it is in our brain, they might have subjective experience. It doesn't mean that they need to have goals. I think we can build machines that have these capabilities. In other words, they can help us solve problems by telling us how, you know, what is the problem? What is the good scientific understanding of what is going on and what might be better solutions? But they're not trying to achieve anything except be as truthful to the data, what they know, what they have observed.
What then is the disaster scenario of something that can pass the Turing test that you're worried enough that you're saying, look, we need to treat this the way that we would treat anything else dangerous, whether that's the environment, whether that's, climate change, or whether that's nuclear weapons, like to put it on that level, just at the Turing test level, give me the disaster scenario.
We already have trolls, right, that are trying to influence people on the internet, social media. But they're humans, and you can't scale the number of trolls very easily. This would be too expensive, and maybe people would not want to do it, even if you paid them. But you can scale AI with just more compute power. So you could have AI trolls that, I mean, I think there already exist AI trolls, but they're stupid. It's easy to, you know, interact with them a little bit and you see they're not human. I mean, they're repetitive and so on. And so now we get to the point where you could have AI trolls that essentially invade our social media, invade or even our email. And in fact, they could do better than that. It could be personalized. So right now, it's a little bit difficult for a human troll to have a good personal understanding of every person that they hit on, to know their history. I mean, it would just take too much time for them to study you and multiply by a billion people. But an AI system that could just have access to all of the interactions that you've had, the videos where you spoke, the texts that's available on the internet, they could know you a lot better, right? So how could that be used? Well, it could be used to hit on the right buttons for you to change your political opinion on something. It could be used to even fool you into thinking you're in a conversation with someone you know, because they can know you and they can know your friend, and they can impersonate your friend, at least text at a text level. So I don't think we have these things, but just we're just like one small step away from having these capabilities.
As I was thinking through this same problem, I was thinking, here's a terrifying example. Dear parents, AI is going to reach out to you, mimicking your child, asking for money. And so it's not a Nigerian prince anymore. It's, Mom, something happened at school, whatever. They talk in their language. They reference things that you don't think that they could have possibly put out there. But of course, if the AI is good at image recognition and it knows that you guys were on a beach 7 years ago, like it could replicate things in the form of a memory that you would never believe that anybody else could possibly know. But we leak, especially kids, leak so much data out into social media that, to your point, the AI would be able to have so much context. So at my last company, we got socially engineered and they convinced us to wire $50,000. And when we went back and looked at the emails back and forth between our finance department and the COO, it was so believable. It wrote, like, it was obviously a person, but it was writing like they would write to each other. And I was really flabbergasted. And so to think that a human could do that, to your point, is very hard for them to get the amount of context as it takes so much time. But when AI is doing it and it can churn through everything that those two people had ever said to each other ever online, that gets really scary really fast. Okay, so if we did this pause, the letter that you guys wrote, and we paused for 6 months, and we were going to hold a convention in that time, and all governments were there, Yoshua, and you're up on stage, and your job isn't to tell us what to do, but it's to open the conversation in the right place. Where would you open that conversation? What do you want us focused on? I'm guessing it's like, we need to limit this or something along those lines. Where do you begin?
I don't know for sure exactly how these technologies could be used. You and I can like make up things. Maybe some are going to be easier than we thought. Some are going to be harder. But there's so much uncertainty about how bad it can turn that we need to be prudent. So prudence here is something that we need to bring in our decision-making individually, because we're going to be facing potentially these attacks, as nations at the planet level. Yeah, that would be my main message, that the technology has reached a point where it can be very damaging, and there's too much unknown of how this can happen, when it will happen. And even the strongest expert, even the people who built the latest systems, can't tell you. It means that we have to get our act together, and mostly it's going to come from governments. So we need those people to get quickly educated, and we need to also have scholars, experts, not just AI experts, but like, you know, social scientists, legal scholars, psychologists, because, you know, this is the psychology of how this could be used, how to exploit people's weaknesses, in order to do the work, the research, also like, what sort of precautions do we need? So there are very simple things that we can do very quickly. For example, watermarks and content origin display. So watermarks just means that one company, say like OpenAI, puts out their software, they could easily put out another software that anybody could run that can test with 99.99% confidence whether a text came from their system or not. So humans wouldn't see the difference. But for a machine that has the right code, it's very easy. If their system is instrumented properly, in other words, they kind of sneak in some bits of information that are not, you can't notice. Statistically, there's no difference. But the chances of having this particular sequence of words would be very, very unlikely and would go to zero quickly as the length of the message increases. So watermarks are easy to put in. technically speaking. And they would say, this text comes from this company, this version, whatever. Okay, so a piece of software running on your computer would be able to say, oh, by the way, the text that you gave me to read is coming from this company, blah, blah, blah. And then we need that information to be displayed. Because, of course, you know, being able to detect that it's coming from an AI system is one thing. But when you have a user interface, it should also be mandatory. Like if I'm on a social media in particular, and I'm getting, I'm interacting with some character out there online, I need to know that that character is not a human. And so that must be displayed. If I get a picture or a video or a text in an email, I need my email software to tell me, warning, this is coming from, you know, OpenAI GPT 5.6.
Okay, so I'm going to push back with the obvious thing, and I think I won't even have to play devil's advocate here. I maybe I'm not more pessimistic than you, but I am in the toothpaste is out of the tube and there's no getting it back in. So I, as a way to move all this forward, let's you and I actually debate the reality of all this. So I'm at the governmental meeting. You start saying that. My immediate reaction is, Yoshua, China is going to develop this if we don't. If we put the brakes on this, they're not going to. And this is a winner-take-all scenario. We cannot allow ourselves to get behind. What say you?
It's a good concern. And that's why we have to get China around the table as well, and Russia and all the countries that may have the capability to do this.
But Russia right now feels hemmed into a corner. Putin is literally intimating that he's going to use nuclear weapons. There's no universe. Like, we've already tried financial sanctions. That's caused them to, you know, start trading in non-dollar denominations. They're grouping up with China, Brazil, South Africa, India. They don't care. Like, they're going to use that to their advantage. Even bluffing would be a way smarter play for him to say, no, we're going to keep doing it. Even if he wasn't, even if they're like backwaters, it would be wise of him to say, no. In fact, if you don't, NATO, if you don't immediately back off, we're going to unleash a troll farm, the likes of which you've never seen. We're going to completely destroy democracy in the Western world.
Yeah. So first of all, we can protect ourselves without necessarily hampering the research. So I think people misunderstood the letter. It never said stop AI research. It's mostly about these very large systems that can be deployed in the public and then used potentially in nefarious ways that we have to be careful with. It's a tiny, tiny sliver of the whole thing that we're doing. Second, in the short term, we do have to protect the public in our societies with things like trolls and cyber attacks and that can exploit AI. Third, I don't know. I'm not out of my comfort zone here in terms of diplomacy and you know.
You and me both, but it's fun.
But my guess is that the authoritarian governments are probably as scared of this technology, but for different reasons. So why are they scared? Because the same AI systems that could perturb our democracies could also challenge their power. In other words, imagine AI trolls, you know, being able to defeat the protections of the Chinese firewall and interacting with people and, you know, putting democratic ideas in their heads in China. Well, that would not be something that this government probably would like to see. And in fact, I think China has been the fastest moving on regulation, not for the same reasons as we are. So they are afraid of this. So I think they will come to the table. But again, like, it's not my specialty. But at least we, there's a chance that they might be willing to talk. And remember, the nuclear treaties were worked on and signed right in the middle of the Cold War. So long as each party recognizes that they might have something worse to lose by not entering those discussions, I think there's a chance we can have a global coordination. And we have to work, even if it's hard, we have to work on it.
Yeah, I'm not so worried about the hard part as I am what is the natural reaction when you have a very difficult, dangerous thing. And history tells me that we don't come to the table to sign the non-proliferation agreement until we have proliferated so far and we have so many missiles pointed at each other that we finally go, okay, let's not let this go beyond anymore. And let's not let it go out to other countries. Like, we're perfectly fine being in a stalemate with each other. And I worry that a similar kind of reaction will be had here. But I take your point that this is not an area where either of us are an expert, as much as I find it utterly fascinating to pursue that line of thought. But I want to now go back to what would we do to actually begin to limit this stuff. So we need to get people thinking, hey, this is dangerous. That's clear. But then the watermark thing to me works only for people that agree that they're going to do it. But is there a way? So taking the, instead of trying to get people to not do things, how do we build defensive things that even when somebody's trying to hack the system? So I doubt you know this about me, but we're building a video game. And so one of the things you have to think about is this game, people will attempt to hack it. Like that is just, it goes without saying. So rather than me trying to ask everybody, hey, please don't hack video games, like literally, it's the dumbest thing ever for the gamers to hack the games. It's stupid. You end up ruining the fun. That game will die out. And then people will try to invent a whole new game. Far better for everybody to just, let's all agree that we're not going to hack it. But human nature is what it is. And that's never going to work. So what they do is they create an adversarial approach where it's like, I find the best hackers in the world to come in to try to hack this game. And then I figure out what I would have to do to defeat that. So what would an adversarial setup look like in AI when someone's trying not to watermark, but I can still figure out who that came from or is there a signature or something like that we could identify?
Watermarks are the easy thing, and I agree they will only be done by the legit actors. People have already been working on machine learning trained to detect text or images that come from other machine learning systems. But these systems are not nearly as good. But yes, we this is already being developed. And, presumably there's going to be a lot more effort in that direction. And we'll need that as plan B, right? But plan A is already to reduce right now it's just too easy to, you can have an API and just write on top of ChatGPT. We should do all these things. By the way, the kind of adversarial approach that you're talking about is, from what I hear and read, is also what OpenAI has been doing and companies like Google have been doing. they hire people to try to break their system as much as they can. That's exactly what they're doing, red teams. And that's good. We need to continue doing that. But maybe we need to make sure the guidelines for doing that are shared across the board, and people can we ensure all companies have that sort of free testing before it's released to the public, for example.
Yeah.
Well, I want to add one thing, please. About, because you asked like, what can we do in the short term at the beginning of your question. So Canada has a law, a bill that is going to pass into law probably in the spring, that maybe the first one around the world on AI. And it has a nice feature, which hopefully other countries will imitate, which is that the law itself is fairly, simple. It states a number of principles, and then it leaves the details of what exactly needs to be enforced to regulation. And the reason this is good is because it's much easier for governments to change regulation. Regulation can be changed like this. You don't need to go back to the parliament. Mm. And so you could have much more adaptive legislative system, including the law and the regulation. And that's going to be super important because the nefarious uses that we didn't think about, like, they're going to come up and we need to react quickly. If we have to go back to parliament, it's going to take 2 years. Nah, this is not going to work, right? We need to have a system that's very adaptive in terms of legislation.
Yeah, that is inevitable. That brings me back to, we're in this situation because I think people are surprised at how rapidly AI is advancing. How did we get caught off guard? Like, someone like you has been in this for so long. You knew the rate of change. What happened? Is it just we just could not anticipate as we scaled the data up how fast the machine would learn? Or is there, what is the X? We were surprised that the machine did X quickly. What was X?
Pass the Turing test. In other words, manipulate language well enough that it can fool us. The experience I had of...
What I'm asking is, what allowed it to do that in a way that caught us off guard?
Well, that's interesting, right? It didn't require any new science. It's essentially scale that did it.
Hmm. Do you think consciousness is a function of scale? No, right?
No. I don't think so. I mean, some people think so, but there are theories around that. I think scale is probably useful, but that there are some very specific qualitative features of how we become conscious that would work even at smaller scales. Scale is important simply because the job that we're asking these computers to do when they answer questions is computationally very demanding. And this comes from, I have a blog post where I talk about the large language models and some of their limitations. The issue here is that if you take almost any problem in computer science that you can write down formally, like try to optimize this or that, or to find the answer to this and that question, almost all of these questions, the optimal solution is intractable, meaning it would take an exponential amount of computation compared with how big the question is. And so it's like if you want the optimal neural net that can answer questions about that can reason properly and so on, is exponentially big, which means we can't have it. But the bigger our neural net, the better it approximates this. So there's a sense in which bigger is better because of that, even with problems that look simple. So as an example, to illustrate what I mean, consider the problem of playing the game of Go. The rules of the game are fairly simple. You can write a few lines of code that check the rules and tell you how many points you get and so on. The neural net that can play Go and like really win, like in other words, go by the rules and exploit them in order to figure out how, you know, what is the optimal move and so on. That neural net, the neural nets we have now that play really better than humans, they are huge also. And it's just a property of many computer science problems that are like that. Like the knowledge needed to describe the problem, maybe even when the knowledge is small, the size of the machine that's necessary to answer questions, take decisions that are optimal, is very big. So I think that's the reason why we need big neural nets. That's why we have a big brain, even if the amount of knowledge that's involved is small. Now, in addition, the amount of knowledge that's necessary to understand the world around us is also big. I think the biggest part of what our brain does is inference. This is the technical term to mean, given knowledge, how do you answer questions properly, like optimize or take decisions that are good given that knowledge.
Okay. Is inference the ability to apply a pattern that I saw in the past to a new novel problem?
Yes, that's part of inference. In classical AI, things were very clear between knowledge and inference. So knowledge was people having typed a bunch of rules and facts. And so the knowledge was not learned. It was handcrafted. And inference was, well, you have some search procedure that looks how to combine these pieces of knowledge, these facts and rules, in order to answer a question. And we know that's NP hard. That's like exponentially hard. And so we use approximations. It's never perfect and so on. But people didn't use neural nets in those days. They use like classical computer science algorithms that try to approximate this, like A star. Now we have neural nets. And neural nets can do this approximate inference. It can be trained to do a really good job at searching for good answers to questions given that piece of knowledge.
How does it define good? I always assumed that what AI was doing was trying to guess effectively the next letter or the next word. So based on all the patterns that it had seen. So it's like, I've seen questions like this before, and here are the answers that have been rewarded in that a human has told me that it likes this answer better than this answer. And that the pattern recognition of the machine combined with a human ranking those responses from the machine gives us the way that the AI approaches that question to this answer. Am I missing something?
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying makes sense, but there's also a lot of knowledge we have that can be distilled, for example, through how we do it for education, how we do it through books, encyclopedia. So it's not all the knowledge we have, but you can see that. So let me try to put it in this way. Wikipedia is way smaller than your brain.
Smaller than my brain.
Yeah, smaller is a number of bits that are needed to encode it, whereas the number of bits that are needed to encode all the synaptic weights in your brain.
Got it. Yep.
Huge orders of magnitude greater. So if we were just talking about these kinds of knowledge, which is not everything, obviously, like physical intuitions and so on is another kind that we can't put in Wikipedia. But if we just talk about that kind of knowledge, you would want a very big brain just to be able to answer questions that are consistent with that knowledge. That's what I meant. And okay. Right now, that's not the way we train our large language models, by the way. The way we train them is we look at texts that presumably is more or less consistent with that, because that's not even the case. There's like people are not truthful and they say all kinds of things. But even if it were, and then by imitating that text, like predicting the next word and so on, we implicitly encapsulate the underlying knowledge, which let's say is Wikipedia. So again, the argument is scale is important because many problems require doing computation that is intractable if you want to really get the right answer. And so we need these really large neural nets to do a good job of approximating how to compute the answer.
When it comes to platforms that will help you run a business, there is no shortage of options on the market. But if you want to use the best, most advanced, and most efficient platform out there, you need to be using Shopify. For whatever and wherever you want to sell, from launching to going international, Shopify is the global commerce platform that will help you grow at every stage of your business. With award-winning customer service, the internet's highest converting checkout page, and a suite of integrated AI tools, Shopify is your all-in-one platform to quickly and efficiently take your business to the next level. I love everything about Shopify because it makes it so easy to start, run and grow a business. Shopify powers more than 10% of all US e-commerce because businesses that want to grow quickly use Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/impact, all lowercase. Again, go to shopify.com/impact right now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/impact. If getting your hands dirty and taking good care of your car or cars is a passion of yours, then eBay Motors is here for the ride. Because I'm sure you remember when you first saw the potential in that beauty. And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly with eBay Motors. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Okay, so now I'm going to have to get into the nitty-gritty a little bit. This will be really 101 for you, but certainly will be instructive for me and hopefully many others. To say that a neural network is large, what do we mean? Are we just daisy chaining GPUs, CPUs? So when I think about the brain is broken into these hyper specialized regions. So for instance, vision is comprised of this part of vision tracks motion, and I can selectively damage the motion center of your brain, and now you see everything in a snapshot. There's things to deal with corners. And so you can selectively damage the part of your brain that detects corners. There's things that detect straight lines, curved lines. It's all these like hyper specific little bits and pieces. And my understanding of a neural network is it isn't that hyper specialized. It's a lot of the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over and over. Help me understand what it means to be a large neural network.
Okay, so you're right that the brain seems to have very specialized and modular structure, as in different parts of cortex, especially when we look at what neurons do in different parts, we see that they're rather specialized. It's not perfectly easy to like identify what this neuron does, but we get a sense of what it's about. And it's also true of our large neural nets, but to a lesser extent. So people have been trying to give a name to what each particular unit in a large neural net is doing. And we can do that by checking when does it turn on, what kind of input was present. So if we look, a lot of the things that make this particular unit on, and we ask humans, so, you know, what's the category that this belongs to? Then we are often able to give a name. And at least that has been done a lot for image processing neural nets, because it's easy sometimes. You can say, well, it's this part of the image and this kind of object. For text, I know there's some papers doing that. Now, I do think that our brain is more modular, you know, more specialization than what we're currently seeing. By the way, cortex is a uniform architecture, like the part of your brain that is cortex, which is thought to be the part that's more modern in evolution and really essential for like advanced cognitive abilities, is all the same texture. It's all the same kind of units repeated all over the place. And depending on your experience or the kinds of brain accidents that you may have, a different part of cortex will latch on a different job. So these are more or less replaceable pieces of hardware, like our neural nets. There are other pieces in the brain that are not cortex that seem to be much more specialized, like hippocampus and hypothalamus and so on.
I'm at the edges now. That was certainly useful information, but I want to push a little bit farther. So what I'm trying to wrap my head around is I have a vague understanding of how the brain works, very specialized. I do not understand how we scale a neural network unless you're saying that each node, and then I realized to me, a node is either a GPU or a CPU, but I actually don't know if that's true. So first is I would need to understand what is a node inside of a neural net, and then how are the different parts of the neural net programmed to do a specialized thing? We'll start there.
Okay. All right. I'm going to start with the end. They're not programmed to do a specialized thing. That emerges through learning.
Whoa.
That's true of the brain and that's true of neural nets. You don't tell this part of the neural net, you'd be responsible for vision, and this part, you'll be responsible for language.
But that happens?
Yes. You get specialization that happens.
Whoa.
Because they collaborate to solve the problem, the different pieces. That's how learning does. Like even like a simple neural net from 1990 does that.
How complex is that underlying code? Is that really basic, but somehow has these incredibly complex emergent properties? Or is that incredibly sophisticated?
The first.
Whoa.
It's very simple. What the complexity emerges because you have all of these degrees of freedom and you have a powerful way to train each of these degrees of freedom, these synaptic weights, so that collectively they optimize what you want, which is like predicting the piece of text that comes next properly. But let me go back to the hardware question. The hardware we use currently to train our artificial neural nets is very different from the brain. They're very, very, very different. We don't know how to build hardware that would be as efficient as the brain in terms of energy and total compute that we can squeeze into a few watts, right? And we wish we would. So lots of people are trying to figure out how to build circuits that would be as efficient computationally as the brain. Another difference is that the brain has highly decentralized, like at the level of neurons, and we got like 80 billions of them, decentralized memory and computation. The traditional CPU has memory completely separated from compute. And you have bus that transfers information from one to the other to do the computation in the little CPU. That's very different from how the brain is organized, where every neuron has a bit of memory and a bit of compute. Now, people doing hardware have been working to build chips that would have something that's more decentralized, more like the brain. And there are several companies doing these sort of things. They haven't yet, reached a point where it can be a GPU. So a GPU is a kind of hybrid thing where it's really the same CPU pattern, but instead of having one CPU, you've got 5,000. And they each have their little memory, but there's also some shared memory. And it was designed initially for graphics, computer graphics, but it turned out that for many of the kinds of neural nets that we wanted to do, it was a pretty good computational architecture, but it has its own limitation. It's energy-wise, it's like a huge waste compared to the brain, as I said earlier. And a large part of that waste is because you have all that traffic still between memory, places that contain memory and places that do compute. So it's much more parallel than the good old CPU, but much less parallel than the brain.
Hmm. You're so deep in this, it probably doesn't freak you out as much as it freaks me out. But this is like, as I really start to try to wrap my head around what is happening, this feels deeply mysterious. Now, I've heard people say that one of the things is freaking them out, and this is people deep, deep, deep in AI. One of the things that they find unnerving is that they don't understand what the neural network is doing. They don't understand how it came up with a given answer. How is that possible?
It's just a fundamental property of systems that learn. And that learn not like a set of simple recipes, like you would learn how to do a recipe in your kitchen, but learn something very complicated that cannot be reduced to a few formulas, like how to walk or how to speak or how to translate or how to go from speech acoustics to sequence of words. These tasks cannot be easily done by traditional programming. But if you put a machine that can approximate any function to some degree of precision, so a big neural net, and you tweak each of the parameters of that machine billions of times, it can learn to do what you want. It can change its, but then you don't really understand how it does it. You understand why it, you understand the code that specifies how this machine computes, but the actual computation it does depends on what it has learned, which is based on lots and lots of experience. So maybe a good analogy is like our own intuition. These machines are like intuition machines. So what I mean is this: you know how to act in different contexts, like, for example, how to climb stairs. But you can't explain it to a machine. You can't write a program. People have tried. Roboticists have tried. You can't write a program that does that. One reason is it's all happening in the unconscious, right? But there's a more, the reason it's all happening in the unconscious is just too big. It's a very, very complicated program that's running in your brain. And the only way that you can acquire that skill that's reasonable is by trial and error and practice and, maybe some of evolutionary, pressure that initializes your weights close to something that's needed to learn to walk. So things that we do intuitively that need a lot of practice are exactly like what those machines are learning. They can't explain it. We can't explain our own intuition. We just know this is how we should do it. And it's knowledge that's so complex that we can't put it in we cannot put it in a few formulas or a few sentences. It's just that's the nature of things, that there are very complicated things that can't be easily put into verbalizable form, but they can still be discovered, acquired through learning, through practice, through repetition of doing the exercise again and again. I have a grandson who's been learning to walk in the last few months. He was stumbling a lot and going again and again and again. And after a few months, now he's pretty good. He's not like us yet. But it's months and months of practice and getting better gradually through lots and lots of practice. That's how we train those neural nets. And that's why we can't explain why they give this particular answer. They're just like, well, I know this is the answer, but I can't explain to you because it's too complicated to have like 500 billion weights that really are the explanation. Do you want those 500 billion weights? What are you going to do with that?
Okay, let's start teasing this apart. So one of the more interesting things in what you just said is going to highlight the difference between what humans do and what machines do and why, until there is a breakthrough. And I always love saying this stuff in front of experts, so you can strike me down if you think I'm crazy. But I think one of the reasons that a breakthrough is going to be required and that we're not just going to be able to scale our way to artificial general intelligence, and I've completely heard you, that AI passing a Turing test opens up a Pandora's box that is utterly terrifying in terms of its ability to dysregulate the human's ability to function well as a hive herd. But now, the reason I think there's going to need to be a breakthrough is that the reason that your grandson is able to get better over time isn't just the calculus of balance. It's that by doing it, he's building stabilizing muscles. And so his muscles are getting stronger in areas that they didn't need to be strong in when he was crawling. So you get this biological feedback loop of, oh, I see what I'm going to have to do. Part of the repetition isn't just locking it into my brain. Part of the repetition is that I'm going to need to develop the muscle fibers and the strength. Now, how much of that is mediated by the brain and a part of the brain that's subconscious is a huge question and certainly gets to the complexity in your 50 billion parameters and all that. The other part is that his brain is reconfiguring neuronal connections and it's making some of those connections more efficient through a process called myelination. So it's wrapping the fatty tissue to sheathe different connections, just like an electrician would do. And now it's got this incredible biological feedback loop of, I have a desire. I'm goal-oriented. I want to do this thing. This thing is walk. Now, how the interplay of I want to walk because I see my parents walk, I see grandpa walking, I want to do that thing, or I have something in me tells me being over there is better than being here. And so I actually want to locomote to get there and I would figure this out even if I never saw anybody move, which is probably more likely given the babies start crawling and they don't see people crawl. They just have a desire to locomote somewhere. Again, going back to my initial thing about, I think machines are going to need to have desire. They have a reason that they want to cross the road if we want to get to human level intelligence. But let me not fractal too much here. So, okay, we have this biological feedback loop. You're not going to get that with a neural network, no matter how much you scale it up. It doesn't have it doesn't have the ability to change itself yet. Now, maybe it will, and maybe it could architect a new chip or something once it has the ability to manipulate 3D printers or what have you. But for now, it's stuck with a physical configuration of chips, unlike a human, which can morph from muscles to brain matter. It's stuck with a configuration, but, and this feels like the very interesting thing that we've gotten right so far, which is I have figured out the pieces that I need. So whether that's GPUs or the code or both, but I figured out the pieces that I need for that configuration to learn in a very emergent way. So I set up the pieces and then I give it a thing I want it to learn and a quote unquote reward for doing so. And then a massive amount of emergent behavior comes out of that. But it's always going to be limited in a way that human intelligence is not, because of the biological feedback loop. Okay, now that I've set that stage, do you agree that machines will need something that imitates that biological feedback loop? Meaning, I need efficiency here that I did not have a moment ago for me to continue to get good at this thing. And that without that, we're sort of stuck at the highly potentially destructive ability to manipulate language and images, but that's it.
So actually, current neural nets already do what you say. They don't have the biological framework, but they do learn from practice and mistakes.
But can they reconfigure their architecture to get better at it?
They don't need to change the chips. They just need to change the content of the memory in those chips that contains... That says,
so why is the biological loop different?
Why it's different? It's different because it has been designed by evolution, whereas we are designing these things using our means. But fundamentally, let me step back here a little bit to state something important as a kind of starting point. Bodies are machines. They are biological machines. Cells are machines. They are biological machines. We don't fully understand them. We know it's full of feedback loops. We know a lot. I mean, we know a lot of biology, but we don't understand the full thing. But we know it's just matter interacting and exchanging information. So, yeah, it's just a different kind of machine. Now, the question, some people think that, in particular when people were discussing consciousness, because consciousness looks mysterious, some people think that, well, it's got to be something that's based on biology. Otherwise, how could it ever like be in machines? Well, it's I disagree completely with that, because it's just it's just information processing. Now, the kind of information processing going on in our bodies and our brains and so on may have some particular attributes that we still don't have in our current machines. But the specific hardware just needs to have enough power. So, you know, one of the great starting points of computer science, by people like Turing and von Neumann in the early days of computing, is the realization with, for example, the Turing machine, that you can decouple the hardware from the software, that the same outward-facing behavior can be achieved by just changing the software part, so long as the hardware is sufficiently complex. And Turing showed that you need very, very simple hardware, and then you can do any computation. That's like computer science 101. So that would suggest that there's no reason why we couldn't in the future build machines that have the same capabilities as we do. Now, we are still, the current systems are missing a bunch of things. You talked, you know, we talked about walking. And why is it that we don't have robots that can walk? I mean, that can walk as well as humans.
Have you seen Boston Dynamics? That stuff's freakish. It can parkour.
They're not as good as humans by, you know, a big gap. But yeah, I've seen them. But I think the issue is simply that we have tons more data available to train language models than we have for training robots. It's hard to create the training data for a robot because it's in the physical world. You can't just replicate a million robots and then, but eventually people will do it or be able to do a good enough job with simulation. There's a lot of work going in that direction. But I kind of disagree with your conclusion.
Well, so go back to the reason that we don't have robots that can walk is because it's not able to use some sort of model to see enough. Okay. But you're saying the point of that is there's nothing fundamentally missing from the architecture that the AI is running on. It's just a modeling problem.
Yes, the software part, we're still far up. For example, you know, one of the clues I mentioned earlier is that the amount of training data that a large language model needs, like, you know, GPT-X, compared to what a human needs in terms of amount of text to kind of understand language, is hugely different. So that tells me we're missing something important. But I don't think it's because we're missing something in the low-level hardware of biology. Although I, you know, I'm a big fan of listening to biology and understanding what brains are doing and so on, so they can serve as inspiration. But I don't think it's a hardware problem. Now, hardware is important for efficiency. So current GPUs are not efficient compared to our brains, but it doesn't mean that in the next few years we will not be able to build specialized hardware that will be 1,000 times more efficient than current ones. And now there's a much bigger incentive for companies to actually invest in this, because these AI systems are going to be more and more everywhere, and it's going to become much more profitable to do these investments.
Yeah. Man, proliferation of AI is crazy. Before we derail on that, though, I want to ask you, so we're comparing the way that machines are evolving, the way the AI is evolving, to human evolution. I've always thought of evolution as, to use Richard Dawkins' quote, the blind watchmaker. It's not trying to make a watch, but the watch emerges out of what we could probably refer to as a few simple lines of code. It's like replication and the way that it replicates, plus a desire to survive on a long enough time scale.
There's not even a need for a desire to survive. It's simply the selection of those who survive.
Yeah, interesting. Is that a important distinction? Because I worry. Well, actually, I don't worry. This would then maybe what you're trying to get me to understand about why machines don't need a desire. They just there needs to be a selection criteria for the one that does the thing better. And that will be enough to boom, to have the exponential.
And that's the way movement. We train those systems. So the way we train them is that we, if you want, we throw away all the configurations of parameters of the neural net that don't work. And we focus more and more on ones that do. That's how training proceeds. It changes things in small steps, just like evolution does, except evolution does it in parallel with, you know, billions of individuals kind of searching the space of genetic configurations that can be useful, whereas we're doing it the learning way. So we have like one individual big neural net and we're like making one small change at a time. But it's both our processes of search in a very high dimensional space of computations.
If you strive to perform your best in life, bringing your energy and abilities into everything you do, then it only makes sense that you would want to be out on the road with that same power, agility, and performance that everyone expects from you. And there's no better option than the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable SUV yet, the third generation Range Rover Sport. You guys know I love staying on the cutting edge with technology, and the Range Rover Sport's cabin features advanced technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, a must, offering you and your family and friends new levels of comfort and refinement while traveling. The Range Rover Sport provides an instinctive drive with engaging on-road dynamics and redefines sporting luxury for the power, agility, and performance you demand in every area of your life. Explore the Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com. The US dollar's value is being rapidly eroded, and if you want to have at least some of your investable dollars and assets that can't be inflated, you should look at gold. Gold has proven to be a good long-term store of value since literally the Roman times, which is why, even though I have the vast majority of my holdings in crypto, I have a percentage of my portfolio in gold. And if you're interested in learning more about gold, I recommend you contact American Hartford Gold. If you tell them I sent you, you can get up to $15,000 of free silver on your first qualifying order. Click the link in the description or call 866-934-4005 or text IMPACT to 65532. Again, that's 866-934-4005 or just text IMPACT to 65532 or click the link in the description. Please remember, there is always risk involved in investing and there is absolutely no guarantee of any kind.
Okay, so let me... This was something that I heard you say in an interview at one point. I wasn't sure if I was going to ask it, but it's now, as you were saying that, I realize that the entire universe is born of a simple set of physical laws, for lack of a better word. And everything that we see from, because I was trying to think, what is the origin of evolution? Because you said that you don't need it to desire. It just needs to get selected. And then I was like, well, what's selecting it? The laws of physics just dictate that certain things will continue to hold their form and function and others will disintegrate. Okay, so then everything is born out of these laws of physics, which we don't fully understand yet. But do you think there will be similar laws of intelligence that we realize, oh, here are the very simple subset and all of the struggle that we have right now is because much like we don't yet fully understand the laws of physics, but yet we can still build a nuclear bomb, nuclear power, GPS, all of that. So we know enough to do amazing things, but we don't know everything. Do you think we have the same thing happening in intelligence?
That's what drove me into the field. The hope that there may be some principles that we can understand as humans, verbally, like write about them, explain them to each other and so on. Maybe write math that formalizes them, that are sufficient to explain our intelligence. Now, obviously, for this to work, it has to be that it explains how we learn, because the content of what we learn, the knowledge that has been acquired by evolution and then by our, you know, in our individual life, is too big to be put in a few lines of math. So whether this is true or not, obviously we don't know, but everything we have seen with the progress of neural nets in the last few decades suggests that yes, because if you look inside these systems, like what are the mathematical principles behind those large language models? Very few. It's something you can describe, and you can explain. You know, when I teach, we explain these to students and so on. It's not that complicated. It's just like physics is not that complicated. What is complicated is the consequence. So I think there's a good analogy here to also understand the story about intuition and very complicated things that are difficult to put in formula. The laws of physics are very simple. You can write them down. But what's complicated is, well, if you put a huge number of atoms together that obey these laws, and you get something very complicated like an ice storm, it's very difficult to predict because we don't have the computational power to emulate that. It's out of very simple things like simple laws of physics, you get something extremely complicated that comes out, that emerges. And it's similar with neural nets. A few simple lines of code, a few simple mathematical equations, plus, you know, basically that at scale and with enough data in this case, and you get something that emerges that's very powerful and very complicated and not easy to reduce to those initial principles.
Okay, so now I want to bring back in the idea of alignment of desire. So if physics runs off the back of a set of simple rules that does not need to want any outcome, but humans manifest desire, and so we rapidly become the most complicated thing that we know of. Do you think about the problem of alignment? Are AI researchers trying to give the intelligence a level of desire because that would make it more profound? Or is that, am I just barking up the wrong tree? I keep coming back to AI without desire, mildly potent. AI with desire, dangerous beyond all measure and reason.
Yes and no. So yes, with desires and the right, you know, computational and you know, the right algorithms could be very potent and very dangerous and potentially very difficult to align to our needs, our values, and so on. And lots of people are working on this. Like, how do we design the algorithms so that even though we give goals to the machines, they will not end up doing things that are against what we want? So that's the alignment problem. But where I disagree with you is that I think we could have AI systems that have no goals, no wants, but are just trained to do good inference, to learn as well as possible about the world from the data they have, and to recapitulate to us what are good answers to the questions we are asking. So let me explain why this would be very useful. In science, typically we do experiments, and then we try to make sense of that data. We come up with theories, and there could be multiple theories that are consistent with the data. And so different people may have different opinions on them, or they recognize that all of these theories are possible. And at this point, we can't disambiguate between those theories. Then what they do is, based on the fact that we have these competing theories, they will design another batch of experiments to try to figure out to eliminate some of those theories. And then the cycle goes back, because more experiments, more data, more analysis, more theories. And eventually, we hopefully zoom in on fewer and fewer theories. So this is the experimental process of science. We come up with an understanding of the world, but it's not one understanding. There's always some ambiguity. In some cases, we are very sure, but yeah, a scientist who's honest is never, never sure, except maybe for a math, right? So why am I telling you all this? Because that whole process, which is at the heart of all the progress we've seen in humanity, which would be needed to cure disease, to fight climate change, even to understand how society works and people interact with each other better. So all of the things that scientists do to make sense of the world and come up with proposals of things we could do to achieve goals, all of that process could be done by very powerful AI systems that don't have any goals. Their only job is to make sense of the data, represent all the theories that are compatible with it, and suggest the best choice of experiments we should do next in order to get the answers to the questions we want. And that can all be done without any wants, just by obeying some laws of probability that we know that are known, and we just need the computational scale to implement that. And algorithms, you know, that people will discover, but I think we only have the bases for that. So what I'm trying to say is we could have machines that are extremely powerful, more powerful even than a human brain. Like, we have scientists doing that job right now. But I'm looking, for example, in biology, because of the progress of biotech, we are now generating data sets that no human brain can visualize, can absorb. We have robots that do experiments, again, in biotechnology, where the number of experiments is in the millions. A human cannot, like, specify a million different things to try by hand. A machine can. A machine with the right code. And that machine doesn't need to have any wants. It just needs to do Bayesian inference, if you want the technical term. Right? It just needs to do Bayesian inference. Bottom line is we can have hugely useful machines that are incredibly smart, but have no wants whatsoever.
Okay. So it's becoming clearer to me now what our base assumptions are. So your base assumption is that I think AI already does all the amazing things you want it to do, is as dangerous as you could hope it to be, as a tool for humans to use. And the thing that I'm focused on is, in your scenario, I can just tell it to stop and it will stop. The paperclip problem, in my estimation, isn't a real problem if I can just tell it, stop making paperclips, and then it shuts down. Where it becomes a problem is when it's like, no, I want to make paperclips. And I'm going to keep making paperclips, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. And I'm going to go around you this way and that way. And I'm not nearly as concerned. Humans have so many weapons at their disposal. I already know what the world looks like when people have just unbelievably powerful weapons at their disposal. It's manageable. But when the weapon gets to be a million times smarter than I am, and decide what it wants to aim at, and decide when it wants to go off, and nobody gets to tell it otherwise, that's a world that freaks me out. And so when you think about the alignment problem, do you think it's a problem? Like, because in your world where the AI doesn't have its own wants and desires, coming from an emotional place where one thing feels better than the other, and so it has the same type of human desire to go in a given direction that we have, and we know what that's like. People kill for their fucking kids, man. They will do crazy things when the thing feels good enough. So in your world, can't we just tell it to stop?
Okay, so there are two kinds of machines we could build. With the current state of our technology today, there's a choice. One kind of machine is more like us and has wants and goals, and it could decide to do something we did not anticipate. And that could be very dangerous. And people are trying to see how we could program them in a way that would be safer. That's the AI alignment problem. But we have a choice. We don't have to go that route. We could build machines that are not like us, We don't try to make them like humans. We don't give them feelings. We don't give them wants. We see, the thing is, once we understand those principles of intelligence, we can choose how we apply them. If we're wise, we're going to choose a safe path. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't want anything. It just, its training objective is truth.
Okay, so might I suggest when we've gathered all the nations together, you're about to go on stage. What I'm going to try to then get you to convince people is that that becomes the most important thing. Do not give AI desire, period. Like inference only, truth only. That's it.
That's it. That's it. Actually, I think that's the safest route. The problem is we need to have all these people around the table and to agree. And honestly, I'm not sure it's going to work. There might be some crazy guy somewhere who says yes, but then goes a different route because he wants to have fun with those machines that look like humans.
And he's a moron and doesn't realize how dangerous it is?
People are crazy. People have emotions. People are unconscious of the consequences. They think, oh, it's going to be fine. But I'm going to make a lot more money than the other guy because I'm going to use this thing that is more like humans. There's going to be a temptation to build systems that are like us.
Would it be more powerful if it was more like us?
I don't know if they would be. Well, they would be more powerful in the sense of being able to act in the world. But that's also more dangerous. Act in the world based on their goals, right? That's the place which is a slippery slope. And or maybe we can make progress. But even if we make progress with the AI alignment techniques, are trying to design, if you want, rules and algorithms such that even if they have goals, it's going to be safe. But even that is not a sufficient protection because somebody could just decide to not use those guidelines. So having algorithms that make AI alignment work is not enough. We have a social problem. We have a problem of collective wisdom. How do we change our society so that we avoid somebody doing a catastrophic thing with a very powerful tool that can potentially destroy us all? It's not something for tomorrow. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen next year. It's not going to happen in 5 years. But we are on that path, and it's going to take a lot of time for society to adapt and probably reinvent itself deeply for us to find a way to be happy and safe.
When was the last time we had to reinvent ourselves like that?
We reinvented ourselves many times over. But not like that. Of course, this challenge is completely new. But we did. So think about major cultural changes that have happened in the history of humanity. Think about like religions, the invention of nation states, invention of central banks and money. And I'm almost quoting Harari here. So we've created all kinds of fictions, as he calls them, that drive our society and people in ways that kind of work, but are not adequate for the next challenge. By the way, dealing with this challenge also helps us deal with things like climate change and nuclear dangers and so on, because it's all about how do we coordinate the billions of people on Earth so that we all behave in a way that's not dangerous to the rest. I don't know how to do that, but we need our best minds to start thinking about it.
You're really starting to pull together some very interesting threads here. So Yuval Noah Harari's idea of a collective fiction. I've heard other people refer to it as a useful fiction. That's very interesting. Now, my concern is that that works when people don't understand. So I'll go to the most recent one, central banking. So people don't understand it. And you know, you've got the whole idea of what's it called? The Beast from Jekyll Island or something from Jekyll Island, where they go. And to your point, it was very much a decision. A cabal of people went and decided we're going to do it like this and we're going to present it to the world like that. And they did it. And hey, it just quote unquote works. There's very few things though, more unnerving than peeling back that and realizing what it actually is. And so I wonder how we present a useful fiction to the world about AI that will get us all unified in a way that will be useful, but isn't manipulative.
I think that's the essence of what democracy should be, that we rationally accept the collective rules for our individual and collective well-being. So that actually has worked quite well in many countries. But we need to go like one step further in that direction. It can absolutely be truthful and not manipulative, so long as principles of, you know, justice and fairness and equity and so on are respected. People will go with that. But here, I think we need to go beyond, even beyond the kind of democratic system. So in a democratic system, if it works well, right, we don't need to lie to people to get them to accept to go in a particular direction, to vote for, you know, a referendum or something for a particular decision. They should be, in fact, as conscious and well understanding of the decisions that they're collectively taking.
Yeah, getting everybody on the same page, that is the tricky part. That's why when you first said it in the context of religion, it immediately felt like, ooh, if we could pull that off, if we had a collective narrative about what this meant, it might work.
It's not my preferred way of solving the problem, obviously. I would much rather go with like an uber democracy that really goes to these principles even further.
Mm. Yeah, that's where I think I get it. Regulation works. And on the countries that come up to the table, regulation is amazing. We should regulate this. I think you have to do something to your point. Just because it's hard doesn't mean you should stand still. But at the same time, that's the one where I'm like, yeah, well, all the countries that regulate it does not account for the person like you were talking about. That's like, oh, I'm going to go build this thing. They don't recognize second, third order consequences, or more terrifyingly, they do recognize the second and third order consequences and they do it anyway. Or even like, because that gets into the crazy man hypothesis, but having read about Robert Oppenheimer when they were building the bomb and how you just become convinced that, look, the Nazis are building a bomb. We need to do it. We have to do it faster. We'll sort of worry about the bigger problems later down the road. And I very much worry that that's where we are with AI. Okay, I'm going to set that aside for a second because it's terrifying.
So as I said at the beginning, I worry too.
Yeah, rightly so. How we solve the problem is a completely different thing. Let me ask you, do you think as AI continues to come on board, and let's say that we're thoughtful about it, we've got good regulation in place, will it be like dealing with a hyper-intelligent human, or will it feel completely alien to us?
It depends how we choose to design it. So if we build systems that have wants, that have a personality, that have emotions, we could, because the more we understand these things from humans, the more we'll be able to do it. Personally, I don't think that's the wise choice. And so if we go the other route of systems that are useful to us, but not necessarily acting like humans, I think it'll be much easier cognitively, because we won't be expecting those things to interact with us like humans do. They will be just assistants, basically, that help us solve our problems and find solutions.
Yeah, the alien idea, as you were answering that question, I had a wave of, I don't see how we're going to, loneliness unto itself is going to lead people to play with making it emotional. even as I think about the way that we want to use AI in my company, it's to generate very realistic characters in a video game. And I can just see that to make them more and more realistic, you're going to want them. You can mimic emotion for sure. And if we pass regulations, that's probably where we stop, is you create things that mimic emotion but don't actually have them. But to create something that is more realistic, we will. So I want to go back to Go for a second. So in Go, they said that it was like playing an alien. It made moves that were so different. So given that now already you have people saying that it comes at something so counterintuitive that it feels completely foreign, you don't think that even without wants and desires that it's going to feel just...
No, I think it's completely different. The reason that it looks foreign to current players might be the same as the current way of playing Go at the master level might look foreign to somebody 100 years ago. Because we've made progress in our understanding of how to play well, and the strategies we use now may look very surprising to somebody 100 years ago. So it's just that these machines have now trained on so many games that they're like, you know, 100 years into the future, if you want, in the evolution of Go, if we had let things go. So they discovered, basically, it's like science, right? Looks like magic until you understand it. So if somebody from 100 years ago comes today and looks at our cell phones, it's going to look like magic. It's going to look very unintuitive. What? How could that possibly be, right? And we are just used to that. And so I don't think it's because there's something fundamentally different. I mean, there are fundamental differences, but that is just being systems that are more competent because they've been trained on more data and trained longer and focusing on this particular problem in case of Go.
Evolution is one of the big themes that has come out today. If people want to keep up, Joshua, with you and the ever-evolving science that is AI, where should they go?
Well, I have a website. It's easy to find. And a blog where I write some of my ideas. And of course, I also write a lot of scientific papers. My group does. MILA, the institute that I founded with a couple of universities here in Montreal, has about 1,000 AI researchers working on many of these problems. But also thinking hard about the responsible AI aspect and these questions. And there are many people around the world who are thinking hard about this, and it should.